Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're really excited tonight to have New York Times best-selling author Jennifer Cheverini here with her new novel, Mrs. Grant and Madam Jewel. This fascinating story delves into the inner life of Julia Grant, the Civil War general's wife and later First Lady's wife, and how she struggled with her close relationship with the woman who was her namesake and her slave, Madam Jewel. As most of you know, Jennifer Cheverini has also written Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker, Spy Mistress, and Mrs. Lincoln's Rival, as well as her very popular Elm Creek Quilt series. And just to let you know, as a bonus, you can now look forward to her next book, which is coming out in time for the holidays and is called Christmas Bells. It's a story inspired by the poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And now, without further ado, will you all join me in welcoming Jennifer Cheverini?
Hello. Well, thank you so much for coming out to see me tonight. I've been to the Highlands Ranch location of the Tattered Cover many times, and I always love getting such a nice, warm welcome to Denver. This is my first time at the Colfax Avenue store, so it's very exciting to be here and to see all of you. Well, yes, this is my new book, Mrs. Grant and Madam Jewel. It's my 24th novel, and it's my 30th book overall, because I also have those six quilt pattern books that I've done, too. And like so many of my novels, I was inspired to write it based upon a historical figure that I encountered while I was researching an earlier book. And in this case, I first became interested in Julia Grant when I was researching Mrs. Lincoln's Dressmaker. There was a scene from Mary Lincoln's life where it wasn't her first meeting with Julia Grant, but they weren't very close. They didn't know each other very well. And it was in some of the last weeks of the war. Mrs. Lincoln accompanied her husband, the president, Abraham Lincoln, to visit General Grant at his military headquarters at City Point, Virginia. And Mary Lincoln was sometimes prone to emotional outbursts, and unfortunately one very loud and very public outburst happened when she was visiting City Point. And Julia Grant was there. She was living with her husband at military headquarters at the time. And she felt really that it was her responsibility to act as the official hostess. And unfortunately, that meant that when Mary Lincoln had an emotional outburst, that Julia tried to comfort her and tried to soothe her. She didn't accomplish that. All she managed to do was to bring Mary's anger upon herself. And at the height of her anger, Mary Lincoln accused Julia Grant of coveting the White House, of wanting to be First Lady herself, and of wanting her husband to replace her own as president. Well, Julia summoned up all the dignity she could, and she calmly said that she had no wish to aspire to that rank. She was very happy with her current position, and Mrs. Lincoln didn't believe her, of course, and had a retort of her own. But when I read that, I thought how ironic it was that they had this particular conversation, because at this point, neither of those two women could have imagined how soon Mary Lincoln would be relinquishing the role of First Lady, because in only a few short weeks, her husband would be assassinated, and a few short weeks after that, she would leave the White House, and President Johnson would take over. And of course, neither of them knew that a few years after that, Ulysses S. Grant would indeed become president, and Julia would be First Lady. So the irony of that conversation stayed in my thoughts for quite some time, and I always thought it would be interesting to learn more about Julia Grant. Well, and as I did, as time went by, and I wrote a few other historical fiction novels set during the Civil War, and occasionally a detail here or there would come up about Julia Grant. And there were two such details that together inspired me to write Mrs. Grant and Madame Jewel. And the first was that I discovered that instead of remaining safely at home, either with her in-laws in Covington, Kentucky, right across the river from Cincinnati, or in the St. Louis area with her own family, Julia was quite often with her husband at military headquarters. So it wasn't just that one time near the end of the war at City Point. It was in Nashville, it was in Vicksburg, and elsewhere. Very often when General Grant established a safe military headquarters somewhere and he felt that things were secure, he would summon Julia to travel hundreds of miles to join him. And sometimes she would bring one or all four of their very young children along, which I don't think is something I necessarily would do as a mother, but it was just something that the Grants wanted to do. They preferred to have their family together, even if it meant being pretty close to a war zone. And the second detail that came and coincided with this one that inspired me to write this book was when I read another article where, almost as an aside, a historian wrote that when Julia would make these trips, she very often brought her favorite slave along. And this was the first that I had heard that Julia Grant kept slaves. And my jaw dropped, as you might imagine it would, because she was married to General Grant and future President Grant. But at that point, he was, when she was traveling to visit him, he was in charge of the Union armies in the war that was going to presumably end slavery forever in the United States. And here she kept slaves herself. And I thought about what it must have been like for that woman, whose name was also Julia, but who appears very little in the historic record, and I wondered, what was it like for her to be kept in slavery in these camps of the Union Army? And as the Union Army moved along, often slaves would escape the plantations and cross through Union lines, or they would be liberated and they would come, and they were called contraband of war. And they would either move on further north, trying to reunite with other loved ones, or they would stay around with the army and find employment. Women became laundresses or seamstresses or cooks. The men became teamsters or drovers or did manual labor. And I imagine, what was it like for this other Julia to be in the Union Army camp, still held in slavery, and every day she witnessed other newly emancipated African Americans enjoying those few first days and weeks of freedom? And I thought, what was it like? What could it have been like? And what was it like for that other Julia, the one who was married to the general? Did she have any kind of crisis of conscience when all this was going on? And wondering about these two women and their relationship was what really inspired me to write this book. So I thought I would read to you something from early in the story. And as I mentioned, there is very little about the woman I call Jewel in the historical record. But we do know that her name was also Julia. And we know that she was often referred to as Black Julia or Jewel to distinguish her from her mistress. I did not want to write an entire book describing this character that I became so fond of as Black Julia. So I went with Jewel. And I decided to invent or to imagine a way that she might have acquired that name. And this is something that takes place during the girl's childhood. And at this point in the story, and this is a real incident when you read it on your own, this is a historic incident that did happen. Something very upsetting happened to a army officer slave. And the two girls find this out because they see all these officers are coming to Whitehaven, the Dent family country home. And of course, they're curious. They want to know what is going on. What's bringing all these men here? And why are the grown-ups so upset? So they creep over and they listen outside a window to find out what happened. And what they hear is a very upsetting story about terrible treatment of a slave woman named Hannah. And the little maid, as they call her sometimes, is so upset that she can't bear to listen to any more, and she runs away. She scrambled away from the window and fled to the woods, closing her ears to Julia's beseeching cries. She fled to the safest place she knew, the fairy bower, where she lay down on the soft moss and hugged her knees to her chest. Before long, Julia arrived, breathless and anxious. "I knew you would come here," she said, sitting down beside her. "You mustn't be afraid. What happened to that poor Hannah would never happen to you. I swear I'll never beat you, and I won't let anyone else either." She felt a small measure of comfort, enough to compel her to sit up and wipe the tears from her face. But she knew Julia was just a little girl, 8 years old like herself, and incapable of fighting off anyone who might want to hurt her. "I don't like it when people call you Black Julia," the young mistress suddenly declared. "It's not a proper name, even for a servant. But you can't be Julia because I was Julia first." She didn't contradict her, although she was the elder by 2 months, and so she had been called Julia longer. Her mistress was the first to be called Julia at Whitehaven, and she was a Dent. It was fair that she kept the name. "I'm going to call you Jewel," Julia said. "It's almost Julia, but different enough so no one will need to put anything else before it to tell us apart. Do you like it?" "Yes," said Jewel after a long moment. "It's nice." "Then Jewel it is," Julia proclaimed, beaming. Jewel was proud of her new name. It wasn't quite as well-earned as Gabriel's or as fancy as Suzanne's, but it was nice, and it was hers alone. "Miss Julia says we're all supposed to call me Jewel now," she told Annie that night as the weary slaves gathered at the kitchen house to eat their supper, deferred while the Dent family and the livestock were seen to. "Really?" Scooping stew into bowls, Annie gave her an inscrutable sidelong look. "You proud of that odd name, Ginger Girl?" "It ain't odd," said Jewel, lifting her chin. "Some girls called Ruby or Opal or Pearl. Why can't I be called Jewel?" One of the field hands guffawed into his stew. It might have been Dan, but she couldn't tell in the darkness, which on that moonless night was lifted only by the light spilling from the kitchen house doorway and the campfire Tom and Gabriel had built. "It's pretty," piped up Suzanne, the housekeeper's walnut-colored daughter. She would be the maid for Julia's next eldest sister some day, but as yet was too young to be much more than a playmate. "Pretty, huh?" Still clutching her spoon, Annie planted a fist on her hip and regarded Jewel from beneath raised brows. "You ain't called Jewel like no pearl or sparkling ruby. You call Jewel to be short for Julia." "Annie," chided Tom mildly, "she's just a girl. She's 8 years old, old enough to know how things are. She ain't got no mama, so it falls to me to tell her." Annie's expression turned solemn as she crouched low beside Jewel and held her gaze. "Listen here, your new name just a piece of her name, just like she think you know more than a little piece of her. There's us, and there's them, and you one of us." "I know that," said Jewel sullenly. "No, I don't think you do. Listen, Ginger Girl, you ain't never going to be part of that family, no matter what Miss Julia say now, no matter how she hold her hand and tell you she love you. Soon Miss Nell going to be old enough to be a real friend and not just a pesky little sister. And as years go by, you going to be less a friend and more a slave. It always happened that way. Unless you want your heart broke, you best get ready and watch for it coming so it don't catch you by surprise." Miss Julia was different, Jewel told herself fiercely, interlacing her fingers over her growling stomach as Annie filled bowls with stew and she waited for one to be passed her way. Miss Julia was different, and Jewel was different. They were ginger and cream. It was not their fault they were mistress and slave, too. So whether Jewel turns out to be right or Annie turns out to be right, I'm going to leave for you to find out on your own. So I'm just hoping to tempt you into reading all the rest on your own. Well, that was all I was planning to read from the book because I don't want to give too much away, but I'd be happy to take a few questions if there's anything that you're curious about. If there's anything you want to know? Yes.
My history is poor. Where was he from? Ohio?
Yes, he was from Ohio, from around the Cincinnati area. His family lived in a small town on the outskirts of Cincinnati. And then they also lived in Covington, Kentucky, which is right across the river. But they also had contacts in Illinois. They ran one General Grant. Well, he wasn't General Grant then, was he? Ulysses Grant's father was a tanner, and all the sons were supposed to be a part of the tannery business. But Ulysses absolutely hated it. He hated all part of it. What he really liked was, he was an excellent horseman, so he loved working with horses, and he also was very good at and very interested in math. So he wanted to get away and not participate in the family business. So when the opportunity came for him to study at West Point, he took it. He wasn't really so much interested in being a soldier, but he was hoping to maybe be in the cavalry so he could use his horsemanship skills. But the most important thing was to just get out of the family trade. He ended up returning to it at a low point in his career when he really needed the work. But that's what kind of took him away from Ohio. Yes.
So has anybody ever approached you on any of your books about making a movie out of them?
Every once in a while, the question was, has anyone approached me about making a movie out of any of my books? Every so often, I'll get an email from someone wanting to know if the rights are available and wanting to have contact information for my agent, and then I never hear anything again. So there aren't any movies in the works, there aren't any TV series in the works, or video games, or theme parks, although all of those, oh, you laugh, but those rights are also available. So, you know, someone might snatch them up. So if you're waiting for the movie, just go ahead and read the books, because, yes. Well, you know, I am one of those people who always enjoys the book more than the movie, too. But on occasion, you know, on occasion, the film surpasses the book. But, you know, I think it would be wonderful if my books were made into movies. It would expose me to so many more readers, and then it would be great. That would be a wonderful benefit. But on the other hand, then you lose all creative control. You know, someone else can do whatever they want with it. You know, they could change whatever they want, and I would have no say in the matter. And for me, I really love books. I enjoy movies, too. I enjoy television as well. But books are really my first love. And so for me, the book is the end product, not a step on the way to a movie. So, you know, 24 novels, not one movie. I am still very, very happy with the way things are going. So. On the other hand, if any of you know Steven Spielberg... And, you know, you could place this into his hands. I would certainly encourage you to do that. Yes, in the back.
When did you know you wanted to become a writer?
When did I know that I wanted to become a writer? I really have wanted to become a writer ever since I learned how to read, which is many, many, I was going to say years, but let's be honest, many decades ago. And it's really something I've always wanted to do. Ever since I learned how to read, and I just discovered how marvelous stories are and their power to move people and inform and inspire and to really allow you to experience, although it's vicariously to be sure, but to be able to experience other lives. Well, I wanted to share that experience with other readers the way my favorite authors share that for me. So I just really have always been writing and always been a voracious reader. And I just feel very, very fortunate that I actually get to do what I love for my livelihood. And I know that I owe that to readers who have supported my work all the way along, whether they picked up my first book in 1999 or if they just came to them in the last few months. And I know I also owe it to places like the Tattered Cover, wonderful independent bookstores that have invited me for chats with readers like this one and have kept my books on their shelves and have placed them in the hands of readers and librarians too. Librarians have been wonderfully supportive of my career from very, very early on. And so I know, you know, it's something I've wanted to do since childhood, and now I get to, and I really do consider myself very fortunate, and I never take that for granted. Not even on my toughest writing day do I ever take it for granted that I'm very lucky to get to do something that I love. Yes?
I have a friend who's a quilter.
Is it the lady next to you? No? No, somebody else.
No, I couldn't bring her tonight. But
couldn't twist her arm hard enough?
When I was online, I found out about Red Rooster.
Yes, Red Rooster. Yes. Oh, where do you find Red Rooster Fabrics? Well, you found their website? The Red.
I found your website.
Okay. I should have a link to them. If I don't have a link to them, then I need to correct that right away because I thought I had a link to them. But if you Google Red Rooster Fabrics, it'll take you to their website. And then they have a menu option that says where to buy. And you can click on it. And then it will give you state by state what stores carry Red Rooster Fabrics. And then what you need to do is find one near you. And then contact them directly and ask them if they carry my Red Rooster Fabrics. Because they might carry the other beautiful lines that Red Rooster creates. Maybe not necessarily mine. So before you make the drive out, although no drive to a quilt shop is ever wasted, is it? You know? Yes, especially with a quilter. But if you really want to make sure they have that fabric, then you should call ahead and check. And then go ahead and support your nice independent quilt shops. Anyway, even if they don't have mine, so. Now your friend wants a question now too, so you have to take turns.
Being a writer, how do you like set a 9-to-5 schedule? Because you said you have kids.
I do.
So how do you do that? And do you?
How do I have kids? I'm so glad that's not your question. How do I work the writing schedule? Well, how do I work my writing schedule and, you know, having two active boys? You know, they're 12 and 15 now, so it's a lot easier than it used to be because they're in school all day. When they were much younger, it was much more challenging. I would be with the boys during the day, and then sometimes I would have a local UW, University of Wisconsin college student come and babysit them for a few hours in the afternoon so that I could get some writing done. But for many years, I would watch the kids during the day, and when my husband came home from work, he would take over, and I would try to get some writing in. And we worked it out that way. But once the boys were old enough to go to school, you know, like every working parent, you know, you work when you can, and, you know, I try to fit my writing in when I'm not on mom duty, but now they do their own things, and they don't need me to watch them every minute, or maybe they do, and I just don't know what they're up to. But, you know, the whole family, it really is a team effort. Like right now, my husband is home watching the kids, and my mom has come out to help out, and then tomorrow, my husband's going to be joining me at the next stop on the book tour so that I can have some company so I don't get too lonely as I travel. So it really is a team effort. It's challenging because I have all the work of a stay-at-home mom and I have all the work of a working mom. But there are so many benefits to working from home. If, as earlier this week, one of the children is sick and has to stay home from school, I can be there. So it has so many benefits. You know, I get work that I love, and I get to spend good quality time with my kids. So I know that as far as being a working mother, I hit the jackpot with the career choices. And I have so much respect for moms who work and dads who work, and their commute is 2 minutes. You know, I have a 2-minute commute, which is wonderful. So, but, yes. How did I get started quilting? Well, when I was going to get married to the aforementioned engineer, I wanted to have a beautiful heirloom wedding quilt. The problem was I didn't know how to quilt. I didn't know any quilters. And I mentioned I was teaching part-time and trying to be an author. And so I could not afford to buy a beautiful heirloom wedding quilt. So I decided that if I wanted one, I was going to have to learn how to make it myself. So I bought a booklet called Teach Yourself How to Quilt. And just as advertised, it had all the instructions for learning how to make a quilt. So I just followed them step by step. And at the end of the book, I had a pretty wall hanging size 9-block sampler. So it wasn't quite the beautiful, elaborate wedding quilt I had imagined, But it was a wonderful first project because it taught me all the basics that I needed to know, and it really sparked my interest in quilting, not only as an art form and as a wonderful form of creative expression, but also all the evocative block names and the folklore and the history. And it was by becoming a quilter that I decided what my first novel needed to be about. I wanted it to be about quilters. So it inspired my first novel as well. Maybe time for one more if anybody has a question. You have one. Yes.
You seem to focus around the Civil War period. What sparked that interest?
So what sparked my interest in the Civil War period? Well, there are really two different answers. The first is that the Civil War era is so rich with storytelling possibilities, not only because it was this enormous divisive conflict in our country, and really the entire American experiment could have just fallen apart right then and there in those few brief years. But we also see both the best and the worst of what we are as Americans and what we were then as Americans in close juxtaposition. We see terrible loss, terrible carnage, just inhumane treatment, human beings toward their fellow human beings. And on the other hand, we also see people rising to extraordinary acts of courage, of benevolence, of self-sacrifice, and becoming their better selves. And so having those two elements of our history so close together, it just inspires all kinds of stories. And then on another more pragmatic note, it's usually while I'm researching one book that I discover a compelling historical figure that I want to write about for a future book. So when I'm researching Civil War stories, I tend to discover other fascinating people and events from that era. That's not to say that I haven't written about other eras, too. Even with my first novel, The Quilter's Apprentice, I wrote about the World War II home front. In other books in the Elm Creek Quilt series, I've written about the Roaring Twenties. I've written about Prohibition in California wine country. I've written about the World War I era and the flu epidemic, Spanish flu epidemic. Other ones that aren't coming to mind now, but so I have brought in other eras of American history too, even within the Elm Creek Quilt series. So there's so many fascinating eras and places to research that eventually I'm going to get around to them all. So but we'll see. So one last question, then I can sign some books for you. No, you. Oh, well, of course we can't conclude without offering insight into my next book. My next book is coming out October 27th because October 27th just says Christmas, doesn't it? No. Yes. In the stores, it's starting to. Right now the publication date is October 27th, and it's called Christmas Bells, and it is inspired by the Longfellow poem of the same name. And I was interested in this poem because I had heard the carol, and I knew that it was inspired by the poem, but the carol that we typically sing today, I heard the bells on Christmas Day, it doesn't include the stanzas that Longfellow wrote that very specifically address his own time and place, that talk about the Civil War. And I always found that kind of interesting, that they're kind of expunged from the Christmas carol. And then when I discovered that he wrote this poem in the midst of incredible personal loss and grief and despondency, I had to marvel at how when he was in that place in his personal life and was also enduring all the hardships of the war that other people were as well, with a son in the military and all of the worry that ensued with that, I had to marvel at how he was able to write such a life and faith-affirming poem. And one that concluded on such a hopeful note, on such an uplifting note. And I really admired his ability to do that. And so I was very interested in learning more about him and how his creative process brought forth this poem that we are still enjoying today, even if we don't know its origin, even if we only know it as the carol. And I also have this book bridging different eras. So we have the Civil War era, but we also have the modern day, and where I have fictional characters showing how the poem is still relevant to us in our own time. So that'll be coming out. And then I'm working on another book, but I don't have a title for it yet. And I don't know for sure if it'll be published. So, you know, I might need to move to something else, but I'm hopeful that it will be. So something's in the work, but I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. So, but I do, pardon me?
Not even a hint.
Civil War era. Not surprisingly. Such a tease. I know. When I know more and when I definitely have a title and all of that, I always put everything up on my website, and you could certainly go there to see what's coming and look at all the beautiful covers that they designed for my books. They do have a cover for Christmas Bells, and I love it. It's and there's going to be a fabric line. There's going to be a Christmas Bells fabric line, too, by the wonderful people, the wonderful creative team at Red Rooster. So that'll be coming out, too. So tell your favorite quilt shops to be on the lookout for that. So that'll be coming out too. So all kinds of busy things going on. I'm not sure because I'm not sure if the fabric will be out at the same time as the novel, because two completely different companies and they have very different production schedules. So it's hard to say, but it will be out. They both will be out, fabric and book. And I hope you enjoy them both. And I also really hope that you enjoy Mrs. Grant and Madame Jewel, because I really enjoyed writing it. And I hope that you enjoy seeing these extraordinary years through the eyes of these two very, very different women, these very different protagonists. And thank you once again for coming, and thank you so much, too, for continuing to support your local independent bookstore, because that's who brought me here. Tattered Cover, they're the folks who brought me here to Denver, and it's a great city, and I love to visit. So please do keep the store going, keep this wonderful community here in Denver, and then maybe they'll keep letting me come back and talk to you year after year. So thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.